Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Do you have a problem figuring out whether you're for me or Trump and you ain't black?
This Ben Jarofsky Show, Benny J. Bonus Interview, is brought to you in part by the International Association of Machinists and Aerospace Workers, Local 126 and District 8, the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, Local 9, the International Union of Operating Engineers, Local 150, and the Chicago Federation of Labor. Benny J., take it away.
Bonus time on the Ben Jarofsky Show as I speak. It's Friday, May 22nd, 2020, and as you heard from that quip, that Dennis played at the top, the quote, Joe Biden's latest gaffe. So that's where we are. If you hear this show 2,000 years from now, that was what was on the minds. Joe Biden, the Democratic electorate decided, hey, this is a good idea. We'll nominate this guy to go. I just want to say this right now, ladies and gentlemen, do not blame me for Joe Biden's position as a Democratic nominee. I did not vote for him. I did not tell anybody to vote for him. That said, I am voting for him in November.
By the way, he gave me permission to touch him.
Joey B. I've learned to love him, though. As we do with all Ben Jarofsky bonus shows, I ask my distinguished guest to introduce himself. So, distinguished guest, introduce yourself.
Well, hello, distinguished audience. It's great to be back on the show, Ben. Hi, Dennis. I'm David Ferris. I'm an associate professor of political science at Roosevelt University and the author of a couple of books that we're going to talk about today.
Yes.
And it's great to be on the show. I'm so bored otherwise in my whole life. So this is fun.
A little break in the monotony of being stuck at home. David Ferris is the author of book Time to Fight Dirty, which I talk about all the time. Pack the Courts, Pass New Voters' Right Acts, Statehood for the District of Columbia and Puerto Rico, Seven Californias, Revamp the Electoral System. In other words, Dems, don't be stupid. Start playing the game the way the Republicans play the game, and maybe you won't lose elections that you actually win. That was the advice laid out by David Ferris in his book, Time to Fight Dirty. And I'm always praising that book and telling people to either buy it or check it out of the library. You have a new book, David. The Kids Are All Left. I have not read it yet, so I'm at your mercy to understand what it's about. Tell folks what this new book is about.
Yeah, so The Kids Are All Left is about the sort of the long-term drift of young voters to the Democratic Party and away from Republicans. I think, like, you know, intuitively, if you're listening to the show, you won't be surprised that young people are leaning heavily Democratic right now. But the book tells a kind of a longer story about how this has actually been happening since roughly 2004, when young people in the 18 to 29 bracket started voting Democratic by double digits, more than the rest of the electorate. So that original cohort is now in their 30s and 40s, like me. now there's like a huge block that spans about, you know, a 25-year-long super generation of people that vote by double digits, and it's increasing over time. And I think that, you know, the book is designed to puncture some myths about this, because I think if you're a Republican strategy, you would look at that and be like, well, you know, when they get older, you know, like when they buy a house, you know, like when they start paying taxes, you know, like they're not going to do it anymore. So I bring some research to bear on that kind of disproves the idea that people get more conservative as they age. It disproves the idea that large numbers of people switch their partisanship after they turn 25 or so. And it talks about why this is happening, right? So I have two goals with the book, right? I'm trying to convince you that all these people that are currently voting Democratic and leaning Democratic are basically never going to change, and that's a huge problem for Republicans. And I'm trying to explain why. You know, like, it's not like it's not like Democrats are the greatest gift to the human species that have ever lived. You know, so like, why is this happening? You know, so I kind of tell a story about for millennials, you know, and sort of a younger generation Xers like me. It's, you know, it's the Iraq War. It's the Great Recession. There's a lot of political science that says, you know, if you're the party in power, if you hold the presidency during a massive disaster, you're going to turn off everybody who's coming of age in that cohort. You know, that everybody is persuadable. You know, and there's a lot of people that are not persuadable, and we can get into why that is. But Republicans oversaw two catastrophes in the space of 6 years. And it just destroyed their standing with millennials forever. Like, they're never getting those voters. You know, they're gone. Kiss them goodbye. The big mystery is really why, prior to the COVID crisis, the younger folks were not leaning Republican under an ostensibly booming economy. So it's just policy. You know, it's culture stuff. It's the diversity of those groups. Mm-hmm. And these Republicans just seem like they wake up every morning and they're like, how can we disgust young people the most today? As you saw Senator Ben Sasse's quote unquote graduation address last week, we all laughed about it, but it's such a good example of the contempt that Republicans have for young people. You know, because the speech was centered around the idea that young people are too weak to climb ropes. And it's like, no, they're not actually. It's just like this is a dripping with contempt for the aspirations of young people, the idea that everybody's a snowflake and they'll get a trophy and all this stuff. That whole discourse you hear on the left too, but I think it's much more prominent on the right. Is a good indicator of the way that the Republican Party's cultural politics right now are just a massive turnoff for young people.
Let's just, since you mentioned, let me just talk up a little bit about Ben Sasse. I have to confess, I'm not quite sure how he pronounces his name, but he's a Republican senator from Nebraska. He's born in 72. So if my math is correct, he's about 48 years old. He went to Harvard. Mm-hmm. So he has... You know, you would call him an elite. He went to Harvard, you know. I'm just using Republican language. And he's a Trumpster, a MAGA guy. Yeah.
His dissertation won an award. I mean, he's...
What's that?
I said his dissertation won an award.
Yes.
From, like, Yale. You know, I mean, he's not salt of the earth.
No.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, he's not salt. And a very bizarre speech, because his father was a gym teacher and his father was a football coach. And so it was a virtual speech. David, we haven't played it. We haven't talked about it on the show, so it's probably good we're doing this now. It's a virtual speech. And so that may have impacted him to a certain degree, because he's looking into his camera in his house. I don't know where he gave it. And he just found, like, his inner comedian that he wanted to do. And it was this, like, ceaseless riff. It wasn't just contemptuous of the graduates who can't climb ropes, don't even know what rope climbing is, you know, but look, of older people, his football coaches, gym teachers, his parents, just like threw everybody under the bus and then drove over it. And I'm like, what the f- is this guy thinking? You know, I mean, it's not even that funny.
I mean, I've watched a lot of graduation speeches in my role as a professor. And I'm sort of like I'm kind of a connoisseur of horrendous speeches, in the same way that I'm a connoisseur of bad wedding speeches, which is one of my favorite things in the whole world. We've had people come in and just drip contempt for the students, you know, like, your education's worth nothing. Congratulations on your debt, everyone. You know, like, I mean, you see people come in and say, like, just crazy, or people that come in and talk for like 40 minutes when you're supposed to give a 5 minute speech. Just a complete lack of self-awareness. And that's the lack of self-awareness is what you see from Ben Sasse there. It's like, he's trapped in his house like the rest of us. And he's like, what can I do to be funny? Like, why don't I make fun of everyone involved with high school?
Yeah.
It just, you know, it didn't go over well. But I think, like, scratching the surface of that speech, what you see is a belief that young people are weak and soft, you know? When in fact it's like, you know, Ben Sasse's generation and some people slightly older than that really kind of like wrecked the country. And young people are just living in the world that we made for them, man. I mean, I hate the contempt for young people. It just drives me crazy. And in the book, the way I conclude the book is like a little message to older people where I'm like, why will you not listen to the young people who are telling you what they want? And you don't have to do it uncritically, but like, why do you just dismiss it all with a wave of a hand like this? It's just so frustrating.
Well, it's bipartisan to a certain degree, because I remember, I may have talked to you about this in 2016 when Bernie was running against Hillary Clinton, and Bernie was advocating free public education, free public college education. And the blowback was from Hillary Clinton supporters was surprising. I mean, that's such a basic Democratic value. You know what I'm saying? Like, and they trounce it.
Yeah.
You're making a promise you can't keep. You're spoiling kids. I had to work for my scholarship. You know, this is one of my favorite themes, David, the way people reinvent their lives. Okay, you know what I'm saying? People, when they go back, the older you get, you're younger than me, you haven't hit this. In 10 years, you're going to be hanging around with people. They were all poor. They all worked themselves up from poverty. You know, they walked 20 miles to school. It was harder then. And it's just people reinvent stuff. That generation was as pampered as any other generation in this country.
Even if you take it at face value, like, if you went through hardship, don't you want, if you could make a world where that hardship doesn't exist for your children, for your grandchildren, why wouldn't you want to do that? You know, the hostility to free public education is just so crazy to me, because one of my favorite things to do is, I tell students about how much college costs in Europe, you know, and they look at me and they're like, can I go to college in Europe? You know, can I go there? Like, why am I stuck here in America where things cost so much, you know? So it's just, but that's a policy, right? That's like, that's repulsive to young people. You know, the fact that people have to go into triple digit debt, six digit debt to go to college. And it's just, if you take, we've got 20 something years of polling from the Harvard Youth Poll, which actually polls people under 18, you know, like 13, 14 year olds to 18 year olds. If you line up all the policies that we all argue about all the time in politics, you know, taxes, education, healthcare, foreign policy, all this stuff, the Republican Party is just completely out of step with what everybody under the age of about 45 or so wants. And it hasn't caught up to them yet because young people don't vote as much. But they're coming, you know, they're coming for us.
All right. Now that gets to a point I wanted to raise in relation to your argument, the thesis, and the kids are all left. And that is it, the voter turnout. So, okay, I'm with you that the younger you are, the more likely you are to be to the left of the spectrum. But you don't vote at the same rate as older people. So how does that work into your thesis?
Yeah, I mean, if young people voted at the same rate as old people, like, you know, Donald Trump would not be president. So the way to look at this is to think about it in terms of, take that as a given, right? The rate of voting for young people may fluctuate. I think it's going to be quite a bit higher this year than it was in like 2012 or something, right? But you vote less when you're young, you vote more when you're older. Like, that's just a pattern of American politics that goes back decades. So what you want to think about is the composition of the electorate and the different generations that comprise that electorate. And we know that the oldest voters in the United States, up until recently, up until the COVID crisis, were heavily Trump, you know, by double digits, and they're dying off, right, and being replaced by the younger folks who are super heavily Democratic but don't turn out that much. So the thing to think about is that that's true, right, and that's a problem for the left. But it's less of a problem when you have like a 30-year swath of the electorate leaning left, because we're seeing the sort of the leading edge of that trend aging into very high voter participation rates now. So the youngest cohort, the oldest cohort of people that voted against Bush by double digits is now in their 40s. Mm-hmm. And those people are going to vote. And the 30-something millennials are probably going to vote this year. And the sort of the fraction of the Republican-leaning coalition is being reduced every day, particularly during this crisis, which is, it's tragically claiming the lives of people in their 70s and 80s disproportionately. And so you can model what the electorate is going to look like this year, 4 years from now, 8 years from now, and in 8 years, the silent generation, the Joe Biden's generation is going to be gone, for the most part. And what you're left with is, the younger boomers, the people from 55 to 64, 1955 to 64, when they were born, is actually the most Republican cohort in the country. So they're going to be around for a while. But it's like you're eliminating the oldest cohort of the electorate, which is more Republican, but slightly less so. And then you're replacing it like every day, so like a Trump voter dies and is replaced in the electorate by an 18-year-old with a Jacobin subscription, So it's relentless. It takes time. But I think you're going to see the results this year. And I think you're especially going to see the results starting in 2024. When I think the Republican Party, as currently constituted, is going to be incapable of winning a national election unless they change. So the book is kind of like, read it if you want to feel better. Are you depressed right now? Go buy The Kids Are All Left. And you might have a little bit more optimism about the future of American politics.
If you're of the leftist persuasion, that is.
Right. If you're not, MAGA hat wearer,
yeah, it's not for you. and can you purchase it? It's available online right now? Because obviously the bookstores are open in this.
Yeah, the bookstores are open. So, you know what your favorite neighborhood bookstore is. I did my launch event at City Lit Books in Logan Square in 2018. We moved since then, so we're actually closer now to Women and Children First. And they're all taking online orders, and you can pick them up. Like kind of curbside, or they'll, some stores are doing curbside pickup, some stores are doing delivery. The point is you do not have to rely on Amazon to get this book. You can get this book from any major bookstore or retailer, major or minor retailer in the city of Chicago. And if you do want to do a big online retailer, you go with IndieBound. So anything to support these struggling local bookstores is really important.
All right. Now, before we move on to some of the topics of the day, I want to take up the point that you made early on about what a Trumpster would say in response. And I'm going to try to remember this old quote, which I know I will butcher, a combination of my advancing years and my dyslexia. But it's the one that goes, if you're not a socialist when you're young, you have no heart. And if you're still a socialist when you're old, you have no brain. This is a wisecrack that's been made.
Right.
I'm sure you've heard it many times. So the notion is that invariably, as people age, they will move right. It just happens because they get grumpy and their breath gets really bad. So what's your response to that?
take a Tic Tac, first of all. Second of all, so that's in the book, right? That's a quote that's attributed to all kinds of people. It's attributed to Churchill, it's attributed to people even before Churchill. And it has a lot of intuitive resonance with people, because I think we all know someone in our personal lives whose politics flipped really dramatically in a way that screwed up their social networks. My dad, who I love very much, wonderful man, was a Marxist in the 70s and is now he says he didn't vote for Trump, but he's obviously very happy about, he was very happy about what was going on. So he had a very dramatic personal transformation, and it cost him some friends at his work. My mom is still kind of a communist, so that's an issue, but they're still married, so it's fine. They love each other. They just don't talk about it that much. In my life, his transformation, it's such a big deal in our family, because he was such an outspoken leftist when he was young. He wrote a book called Revisionist Marxism when he was in grad school. And it's, everything's totally changed. But, and there was a book a few years ago called Exit Right. Do you remember this? It was, about a bunch of leftists who moved to the right and shaped the 20th century, you know, like Ronald Reagan, David Horowitz, who was a student activist and became like one of the craziest right wingers in the country. So these kind of people, right? And so what I tried to do in the book was just, you know, like, is this true? Right? Like, does this actually happen to people? And of course, in a society of 350 million people, this obviously does happen to some people. But there's no evidence that there's a consistent trend for people to change their partisanship from left to right as they age. Precisely the opposite, in fact. That is, your partisanship is pretty much set in stone by about 25. And then you get less likely to change as you get older. So that, you know, voters in their 60s and 70s are like unflippable. You know, you may switch candidates between elections idiosyncratically, but your underlying partisanship and ideology is not going anywhere. And so they've done, the political scientists have done some research. This is like my last book, right? Like I'm largely conveying the findings of professional political scientists to a general audience. What they find is that there's only like three or four things that can flip your partisanship, as an adult, right? One, you get divorced because there can be a lot of those coming after this is over. You get divorced. You know, you embed yourself in an entirely new social network, and that can change your mind about some things. You move, you know, if you moved from like Brooklyn to South Dakota, and you stayed there, there's a pretty good chance that if you surround yourself with like rural South Dakotans for long enough, that their views might kind of seep into yours and your partisanship might flip. But these are rare events for most adults, right? To embed yourself in a completely different partisan community, or to marry, you know, to get divorced and marry someone who has totally different political views than your previous spouse. And so we're talking about pretty small numbers. I mean, people do change, people do flip their partisanship, but there's absolutely no evidence that we have in social science that people tend to get more conservative as they age.
By the way, go ahead, finish your thought.
No, go ahead.
No, my solution to the problem that Democrats have with the electoral Congress, which this is one of my favorite riffs that you go on, why they put up with it, I'll never know, because it's only twice in the last 20 years that they've lost the election, even though they won the election. So you figure, common sense would say move against it, but no, not the Dems. But my solution is just, you know, take a whole bunch of people from California and make them move to Wyoming. Boom. Took care of that problem. But you're saying, that happened, they would come to Wyoming and start voting like MAGA hat wearers. Is that what you're saying?
But this is my next book, Ben. Honestly, this is like, I've got like 45 ideas to dismantle Republican power. And like a California colonist program is one of them. Another one is like put a national, like 100,000 student national university in the middle of Nebraska. And you flip Nebraska. You know, I've got some ideas.
Yeah, that's a good idea. There goes Nebraska. And then then you watch Republicans overnight would be denouncing the Electoral College as the undemocratic system.
They would hate it. Look, if things had gone the other way in 2000, like if Al Gore had won the election while losing the popular vote, there would have been a tent city in D.C. for the last like 20 years. With Republicans camped out and demanding that the Electoral College be abolished. Yeah. Like they would never have shut up about it.
No. And to that point, let me read to you. I told you I was going to do this. This is one of my favorite themes on this show is how Democrats play the game of politics and how Republicans play the game of politics. The Democratic way of playing it is, nominating Joe Biden on the grounds that a nice guy will win over voters. Meanwhile, the Republicans it's been an onslaught of attack ads against Joe Biden, making up anything they can to turn people against him. So I just got this alert from one of these Trumpster groups that somehow or other picked up my email, and I get 100 a day, I would say. I'm not exaggerating, about 100 emails a day. So I've learned one thing about Republicans. They figured out the internet. So here we go. Here's the headline. Get your thoughts on this. Here we go. Must-win states are slipping away, and it's addressed to fellow conservative. Somehow or other,
that's
I'm
you,
on this
man.
List.
That is absolutely you.
Sleepy Joe Biden's far-left super PAC just announced plans to pour $10 million into ads targeting swing state voters ahead of the election. This means battleground states across the country will soon be filled with leftist smears on the president and his Republican allies. The left has united behind Joe Biden. In fact, the only thing bringing together the liberal establishment and the ultra-progressive base is their shared hatred for President Trump and his MAGA agenda. See, I'm not the only one who calls it MAGA, okay? This is from the conservatives.
Yeah.
They're willing to do anything to capture the White House and the Senate. The time to defend the conservative agenda is now. All right. David, your thoughts on this email that I received from the Trumpsters?
Campaign emails are like a sort of side fascination of mine. During the primary, I was on Joe Biden's mailing list, and you know, they get increasingly like paranoid. And you know, have you ever like right in the lead up to an election, you get the emails that are like, David, all is lost, you know, we're all gonna die if you don't open this email, like the dog gets it, you know, like they, you know, the whole strategy is to get you to open the email, right? Yeah. Like they got to put something outrageous in the headline. But the Trump people really distinguish themselves by having the whole email be insane. You know, it's like the Democrats, it's like you got to do what you got to do, you know, like if this is what the data says, get people to open email, that's fine, you know, you've got to tell me this guy's falling. But they open up a Democratic email and it's like, hello sir, we would love to have your support in this political campaign that we're running against the other team. We are one of the teams, and the other team is the other team, and it would be great if you could help us out. Yeah.
Yeah.
Whereas the Trump emails are just nuts, man. Like, I mean, first of all, like 10 years ago, it would have seemed a little bit weird, you know, to be using like this like casual, stupid ad hominem nickname about the other person.
Yeah.
Constantly in your campaign emails, you know, so Sleepy Joe.
Yeah.
You say what you want about Joe Biden. Sleepiness is not the problem, you know. He's a little bit old. He's not the most coherent person, but he's not sleepy. He's awake all the time, you know. He's busier than Trump is. Did you see his public schedule today? It was like go to the pool, and then Kaylee does a press conference, and he's not doing anything. And I mean, like if anybody's sleepy, it's you, bro. It's like weaponizing normal politics to scare people. You know, it's like, oh, like Joe Biden's going to go up in the air in battleground states. It's like, what do you think an election is? You know, like you guys, you're the ones that did Citizens United, and now you're upset that people are taking out ads in swing states. Like, I don't understand what you expect Joe Biden to do if he's not going to advance his far left agenda. You know, should he sit on his heels? Should he just like just YouTube from his basement and like, you know, tweet? By the way, if you are on Twitter all day, like the rest of us, you know, nothing else to do. There's like multiple Biden parody accounts that actually are just like the one thing giving me life right now. One is a Biden insult machine. So it's like, you know, like, I'm going to stuff you in the rain barrel, you milk delivery man, you know. It's really good stuff.
Well, his latest today, you ain't black, which he's already apologized for. I tell you, one vote will be swung one way or another from that thing. I guarantee you that, okay? Guarantee
no,
you
this
that.
No, this is just silly season stuff, you know? I mean, should he have said it? No. Was he obviously kind of just joking and trying to be cool with his, you know, with his black hosts? I think yes. And it's just, you know, it's like one of these painful things where like super old white guys try to be, you know, hip with the young, diverse crowd, you know, and they're like, you ain't black, you know,
yeah.
It was bad. But like, again, here's a Democrat, you know, it's like, he's like, oh, I did something wrong and I need to apologize for it. Whereas the, you know, the reigning ethos in the White House and on the right is like, you know, Trump would be out there being like, I never said that. You know, if somebody would play the tape.
Yeah.
They're like, this is you, right? This is you on the tape, right? And he's like, I didn't say that. And then Kayleigh McEnany would call it fake news. And then like, you know, the Federalist would run six articles about how Obama did it too. And, you know, it's like this whole like wandering cycle where they avoid accountability for anything. Whereas like Democrats are still like, I'm so sorry.
Yeah.
I said a bad thing. Like, I said a bad thing. Please God, please forgive me.
No, that is so Democratic. You're absolutely correct. And I mean, it's really pronounced with the Tara Reid, E. Jean Carroll thing, which we'll get into. But having said that, before we go to Tara Reid and E. Jean Carroll, your thoughts on what if Biden had done Trump way? Do you think he could have got away with trying to skirt around? Just if he had employed the Trump tactic, do you think that would have been a good tactic to choose, or do you think that this is just the way Democrats have to do things?
Sorry, could you repeat the question, Ben?
In other words, if Biden had responded the way Trump would, just the way you outlined it, like sort of denying that he said it, pretending that he didn't say it, changing the subject, counterattacking anybody who criticizes him, do you think that would be a more successful tactic, or do you think it's just the way it has to be with Democrats where they apologize all the time?
It's a great question. You know, I mean, I think like when you say something that is offensive to one of your core constituencies, I still think it's smart politics to apologize, you know? Not bringing any fresh news to your listeners here, but Democrats need, you know, every African-American vote that they can get everywhere, right? It's a critical part of Democrats winning power. And so when Biden screws up and says something offensive, you got to fix it. You know, I mean, in an ideal world, Joe Biden would not be the nominee going out and saying like weird stuff on YouTube, but like, here we are. Right. And so I still think that's the right thing to do. Where I think that like, you do want to kind of adopt a little bit more of a Republican mindset, is about sort of broader policy issues. And so, you know, what's been going on in Congress is a great example, where this like $3 trillion bill that passed the House that's going nowhere in the Senate until Democrats capitulate on X, Y, and Z to McConnell does not include an ongoing stimulus payment to Americans. So I think it's like the only thing really economically that's going to get us out of this crisis. And they did it because they were like, I don't know how the media is going to cover this if we say that we want, you know, $1,200 to Americans every month for the next 3-4 months. And it's sort of like this this preemptive capitulation to the narrative builders at the New York Times or whatever. You know, it's like you're afraid. The Democrats remain very afraid of what the headline writers are going to write about their policy proposals. You know, you saw it in this. You saw it during the primary when Democrats farmed out their debates to all of these moderators who were like, "How will you pay for your stupid, insane proposals, Bernie and Elizabeth?" And it really, I think that questioning of the debates really altered the trajectory of the whole race. And so that's where I'm like, don't apologize, you know, like don't explain how you're going to pay for it. Don't engage with this nonsense, hectoring about the cost of things. Like, don't feel like if you have a good policy idea, stand behind it. If you have a good idea about the direction to take American foreign policy, like stand behind it, you know, like don't adjust your strategy to fit the needs of an imaginary, like New York Times reporter who's going to write a bad headline about you. You know, when you screw up and you alienate people in your constituency, apologize. When you're doing good politics, good progressive politics, stand behind it, fight back and fight hard. Like, you know, the time to deploy those emails that are like hostile, you know, and are like, these people are crazy, is when you're defending something that's like really important about the future of America. You know, like if you want to insult people, insult them for not believing in free public education. You want to insult people, insult them for not believing in Medicare for All, which is like the most obvious thing in the whole world at this point, because 30 million people are about to lose their insurance, right? And people are like, Biden said something offensive on his YouTube podcast. It's like, okay, fine, right? Apologize. But like, you know, use your strategic ruthlessness for the right thing, you know, and use your, you know, your sense of decency and your sense of obligation to the truth for the right thing. And if that makes sense, like, you know, apologize when you have to keep your coalition together. Apologize if you have to, deplorables is a great example of something that should have been walked back a lot quicker than it was, or something that should not have been said at all, you know? And so this isn't a case where Biden should have just like dug in his heels and been like, how dare you question me? Like, obviously you aren't black if you don't vote for me, you know, like that's what Trump would do, right? He'd be like, I take your race card away from you. If you vote for the other team, you don't get to call yourself African American anymore. You know, like, he can't take that stance, right? Like, because Democrats are too, like, reality based to believe Joe Biden's spin about this comment as anything other than like he screwed up, right? Yeah. He screwed up and he apologized.
You know, actually, when you made the deplorable reference, I'm thinking about what you just said. When Hillary Clinton's deplorable comments came in if my memory is correct, it wasn't a public speech, correct? It was a remarks to, okay. And so I, in a million years, Donald Trump would not apologize for if he used the word deplorables about the Democrats. And so the argument you're making is when you insult or denigrate your base, that's when you apologize. But if you insult the people who aren't going to vote for you, so what? This is the thing that Democrats, again, so they're all still to this day, oh, terrible that she called them deplorable. They weren't going to vote for her. Not one vote changed because of deplorable. I'm telling you right now, the people that she was saying are deplorable weren't going to vote for her no matter what. And the people who like the fact that she called them deplorables were never going to vote for Donald Trump in the first place. But Democrats, this is to your point, David, they're still just, we can't say anything bad about the other side. We have to be
afraid of their own shadow. Like afraid of their own shadow. Yeah. I think I just, like, in retrospect, I would have preferred that comment be made, like, after she won the election. You know what I mean? Because even if it was like 1% of the electorate or something that she offended, like, you know, it was such a close election that I do think there was a little bit of damage from that remark. Although who knows, you know, when you throw in like Jim Comey and the Russians and all this other stuff, like who really knows?
Yeah. And sleeping in Wisconsin, not going to Wisconsin to campaign, that may have hurt too, you know?
Yeah. That was not great. That's not great.
All right, let's look ahead to, instead of talking about 2016 forever, let's look ahead to this current election. You had a tweet that you put out, Trump's bad battleground state polls. So what's your, explain that, what you were getting at in that tweet.
Sure. So I wrote, as you know, a lot of journalism work has disappeared. So I've been cut down to once a month at the week. They're wonderful that they're keeping me on at all. But I wrote a piece about how Trump's electoral edge has like kind of disappeared. I'll tell you, not all the professional modelers don't necessarily agree with me about this. I'm just looking at polls. And it looks like Biden's national margin is about the same as it is in the most important swing states, which to me makes it much less likely that he's going to win the popular vote but lose the electoral college again. I'm actually for complete transparency, I'm a little bit out on a limb here in terms of this analysis, because the Nate Silvers of the world don't see it this way because they have their models. But what I'm seeing is that Biden leads in Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, Arizona, even North Carolina by about the same margin that he's leading in the national polls. So the battleground polling for Trump is just dreadful. You know, his polling average, he's behind in almost every single consequential swing state. He leads in Ohio. He leads in Iowa, if you still consider that a swing state. And he trails pretty much everywhere else. If you're just taking a straight average of the last, like, four public polls that were released, and you're not doing any fancy sort of adjusting for the pollster's reputation or this or that, just take the averages, which is all that's available to anyone right now. He's in bad shape. I mean, like, if you took the polling averages and you plugged them into an election model, Biden would win anywhere right now from like 351 to about 405 electoral votes. So Trump is behind in so many different places that he absolutely must win to be reelected. That they're like, what the reigning attitude in the White House right now should be just like absolute, like 24/7 dawn to dusk panic, because they're bad. Like the polling is really bad for him. I think people are so traumatized by 2016, that they think this polling is just like a mirage or something. And it's not, You know, I mean, the some of the state polling was a little bit off in 2016. I think in part because they stopped polling some of the states that flipped in the week before the election. The national polling was spot on. It was spot on the whole time. That's been true for a long time. And Biden is up 6, 7, maybe even 8 points right now in the national polling. I'm as disappointed as anyone that Biden is the nominee, but he looks to be in a really good position right now.
And what are some of these key swing states? Just rattle off a few of them that Biden said.
Yeah, sure. So you take the three states from the blue wall, the so-called blue wall that Trump won, Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin. The polling in Pennsylvania and Michigan is so bad for Trump that if I was a Trump strategist, I would just write them off.
Wisconsin and Pennsylvania, did you say?
No, Pennsylvania and Michigan.
Okay, gotcha.
The polls there have been consistently bad. Trump has not really led any reputable public poll in either of those states all year. And the good polls that are coming in are anywhere from like Biden +4 or Biden +8, sometimes even more than that. But if you freeze the 2016 map and you add Pennsylvania and Michigan to it, Democrats still lose. So they need to pick up one state out of the following group, right? It's Wisconsin, Arizona, Florida, North Carolina, Georgia, or this is getting a little bit deep into the weeds here. If Democrats, because there's two states in this country that split their electoral votes by congressional district, that's Maine and Nebraska, and Clinton lost Nebraska's second district. It's the second in Maine's second district. If Democrats could win Pennsylvania, Michigan, and they took both of those districts in Nebraska and Maine, they would also win. But I think the more likely path is you take one out of Arizona, Wisconsin, North Carolina, Florida, or even Ohio, which looks competitive right now based on the polling. So you're looking at a situation where if I'm the Trump campaign, I'm writing off Pennsylvania and Michigan. You know, maybe I invest there to lure Biden into spending money and time there, which he should anyway. But I don't think anybody in Trump world seriously thinks that they're going to win Pennsylvania or Michigan. And so the whole election really comes down to this set of like 4 or 5 states, and Biden leads everywhere right now.
And presuming that Biden holds on to all the states that Hillary Clinton won, like Minnesota or New Hampshire.
Right. And the polling looks just dreadful for Trump in those states. There's not been a lot of public polling of Minnesota, but Biden's up by double digits there in the polling that we do have. New Hampshire, Biden's doing very well. There's not a plausible candidate for a blue state to flip to red. And so you're kind of assuming the map is frozen from 2016, and then you're flipping X number of states from red to blue. And there has not been any election in the last 150 years in which fewer than two states have flipped between the parties, between elections. The 2012 was one of the lows of only two states changed hands. But I think it's like really, really unlikely that it's going to be only two this time. So nobody should be complacent, right? Like, there's all sorts of factors that are working against Democrats, from voter suppression to whatever, chicanery that they're going to pull around the pandemic with vote by mail, all this stuff. Like, there's all sorts of reasons why there are structural obstacles to Democratic power. But I think the most consequential change in American politics right now is that Arizona seems to have flipped blue. Like, just it seems to have done what Virginia did between 2004 and 2008. Which is that it went suddenly from like a Republican-leaning purple state to becoming a Democratic-leaning purple state sort of overnight. Mm. The Senate candidate, there's a Senate election in Arizona this year where Martha McSally, who was appointed to her seat, is going up against Mark Kelly, who's the wife, the husband of. Her name is escaping me right now, but the congresswoman who was shot in the head early in the Obama, and he's like, an astronaut, super popular. I mean, he's leading that race by 8-9 points, which is just it just would not have been possible in the political universe that existed before 2018. And so that means that Democrats can still lose Wisconsin, where I think the polling is not as great. If they win Arizona and they take back Michigan and Pennsylvania, it's over. Game, set, match.
Well, I listen to what you say, and I look at how the Republicans are responding, and we see response where these rallies to open up the state rallies targeting Democratic governors and Confederate flags, Nazi signs and swastikas, people with guns. And it seems as though they're convinced that this is the way to win an election. And yeah, it's either a sign of utter lunacy on the part of the Republicans, or a sign that it's really scary in our country right now, if they are correct. So how do you see it?
I mean, I think that the public opinion on this issue is still very, very strongly in favor of ongoing restrictions, if somewhat loosened, as opposed to, you know, the sort of pure, I need to go to the barber and I don't want to wear a mask crowd. You know, I think a really big majority of Americans, you know, 3/4 of Americans, think that we have to maintain some changes in our daily lives, changes which we all agree suck and we hate them. But we don't want to die, and we don't want our parents and grandparents to die. And so we're willing to do them for a certain period of time, I think, moving forward. I think that the Trump's messaging on this has been completely incoherent from the start, in the sense that, you know, he's tweeting out, you know, liberate Michigan, liberate Wisconsin. At the same time as his own CDC is standing by their guidelines about when to reopen. And then he went out and yelled at Brian Kemp for opening Georgia too soon, right? So it's your average independent voter who doesn't pay that much attention to politics, I think is going to have a really difficult time reading the signal of where the Trump administration is on this, except that they're bad at everything, you know? And it's such a missed opportunity for Trump, because if he had just taken the whole situation seriously and soberly from the beginning, whatever he decided to do, I think he would have gotten a lot more buy-in from the general public if he had not dismissed it as a Democratic hoax to take down his presidency, if he had worked harder, if he had taken seriously the concerns of healthcare professionals. And that's true even if the response was, you know, in retrospect, we're maybe we went too far to prevent a disaster, but it seemed the right thing to do at the time. I think he still would have come ahead in that scenario, because he would have appeared as a person who cared about whether people lived or died. He doesn't seem to care about that right now. And so the other piece of this is that, I don't know if I'm sure you've seen what's been happening in Illinois the last few days. We're moving into phase 3. Some things are going to be reopened. There's actually not that much daylight between what Illinois is planning to do over the next month and what Georgia and Florida are planning to do over the next month. It's a difference in degree, but not really in kind, right? It's we can't keep going like this with everything shut down indefinitely, right? It's going to be just a generation defining catastrophe. So if all of the states, Democratic and Republican, are doing roughly the same thing, and then we still end up with a big problem in the fall or the winter, again, that's going to come down on Trump, because we didn't put into place the testing and tracing systems, you know, that they've deployed in countries that have successfully fought the virus. And so I just don't think that he's going to be able to single out, you know, governors X, Y, and Z, because the reality is Mike DeWine in Ohio, Charlie Baker in Massachusetts, Larry Hogan in Maryland, there are Republican governors who are taking it seriously and are taking their role as public servants seriously. So I just don't know. I don't really know how they thread that needle. I think if we have another spike in the fall, it's not just going to be a human tragedy, and I really don't want it to happen, but I think it's going to be really bad for the Trump administration, because what their line has been up until this point is we've got this under control, the economy is going to make this V-shaped recovery, and then we're going to get on with our lives, and who do you trust more to turn the economy back on than Donald Trump? Yeah. And I think that by September or October, that message is going to be not just wrong, but obviously hollow, because even if you're an optimist, a lot of industries are not coming back, and until we have a vaccine or a better treatment. So, I'm just always at a loss for what it is that they're thinking in the White House, but what they're doing is just not working.
Well, I'll close it by saying this. To the point you made, that if Donald Trump had been a little more conventional in his thinking and approached the crisis that he faced with in a rational way, listening to scientists, listening to doctors, abiding by their cautions and their advice, if he had been that kind of president, or a politician, he never would have been elected in the first place. That is, everything you just said about Donald Trump is the opposite of who he is. And he's, you know, incapable. I remember that first speech. This is how wimpy Democrats are, David. This is how wimpy the mainstream media is. And Donald Trump, I remember that first speech that he gave where it was, to Congress, and his first State of the Union speech. And he was more or less serious. And everybody was like, oh, my God, they all just want to run. The mainstream media Dems just want to always prove how open-minded they are. You know, they embraced him. And like within a day or two, I don't know, he was being the idiot that he, you know, tweeting and making fun of people. And so it lasted for like less than a news cycle. It just.
Yeah.
He is who he is.
It's like that, you know, the meme about, you know, this is the day that Donald Trump became president. And I think it's from Fareed Zakaria very early on in the administration when he like bombed something, you know. And it's like we keep waiting for him to turn into a president, and he's just not going to do it.
No,
he's just never going to do it. The irony is, he would be a much better bet at re-election if they could just swap him out for like some idiot that looks like him, who could go out and be like, my fellow Americans, I care about your pain and suffering. Yeah. I'm really sorry this is happening to you. This is our moment to be, you know, to be strong and resilient and have the courage. And I know you're going through a hard time. We're going to do everything we can to help you. Red states, blue states, you know, we're all in this together. But dude just can't do it. No. He just can't do it.
Can't do it.
You know?
Can't do it. All right, David Ferris, the name of the book, The Kids Are All Left. I shouldn't let so much time escape in between your appearances. It's so much fun talking to you. So people,
that's great.
Buy the book, read the book, and we'll bring you back on sooner than the last time, David, and we'll continue the conversation, all right?
Look, I got nothing going on until August, so anytime you want me on the show, please just let me know.
There you go. You shouldn't say it there. You should go, I'm so busy, Pat. I'll try to squeeze you in. All right. Stay safe. That's the great David Ferris, and that's another Ben Jarofsky Bonus Show. Take care, everybody.